Well, let's get the meeting of the State Government Finance Division started here, called to order. Representative Elkins, have you had a chance to read the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll move their approval. This is for the meeting of February 25th.
Representative Elkins moves that the minutes from February 25th be approved. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. First bill we have on our calendar for today is House File 3616, Representative Lee. I'll make the motion that we move that this bill, the House File 3616, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members for the opportunity to present House File 3616. House File 3616 is a bill that expands opportunities for small Minnesota businesses that have historically experienced economic challenges. This bill deals with the Department of Administration's small business targeted group program that encourages state contracts with small, minority, veteran, and women-owned businesses, as well as business owned by people with disabilities and businesses located in economically disadvantaged areas of Minnesota. The Department of Administration have an equity select tool that vets target small businesses who enter into a group which can receive small contracts without entering a competitive bidding process. Currently, the maximum value of the contracts that can be awarded this way is $25,000. This bill would increase it to $50,000. The bill also expands the existing 6% preference for a targeted group business in an award process to 12%. Expanding these tools will continue to help diversify the recipients of state purchasing. And Mr. Chair, Commissioner Alice Roberts-Davis is here to provide testimony.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Alice Roberts-Davis. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Administration. And as Representative Lee said, this bill proposes two changes for our targeted group business program. This program is directly intended to impact businesses that are small and owned by minorities, women, veterans, people with substantial physical disabilities, and people who live in economically disadvantaged areas of the state. In 2015, the legislature provided funding for us to create our Office of Equity and Procurement, which is charged with administering this program. It's a small team of six that works to promote opportunities to do business with the state and provide assistance to these targeted group businesses. The first tool included in this bill increases the maximum contract that can be awarded directly through our Equity Select program from $25,000 to $50,000. In FY19, state agencies used this tool 430 times, resulting in $5.7 million in purchasing from our targeted group businesses. Increasing the maximum amount allowed will provide additional opportunities while maintaining a competitive bid protection for larger contracts. Just to give you some context, we spend about $2.5 billion a year, so you can imagine that a $50,000 contract is still quite small. Equity Select has been a very effective tool in increasing the diversity of state spend, and raising this threshold will allow us to continue to bridge more of those gaps. The second tool in this bill expands the preference and an award for a targeted group business from 6% to 12%. The Office of State Procurement reviewed contracts awarded in the last year and found that the current level is not adequately serving our targeted group business program. The Office of State Procurement reviewed procurements from fiscal year 19 with a single award and found that of their 862 procurements reviewed, the proposed increase in the preference would have resulted in an award to targeted group businesses in additional 13 cases, or just 1.5%. By establishing the Office of Equity and Procurement and authorizing the Equity Select and Targeted Group Preference programs, the legislature has set equity and state contracting as a priority. This bill asks for the tools that we need to better use state purchasing as a tool to reduce Minnesota's economic disparities. We're proposing these changes at a time when we've achieved a significant increase in the diversity of our state procurement, but also that we have significant ground to make up. In fiscal year 2019, state purchasing from targeted group businesses exceeded $100 million for the first time. That's a 58% increase since our program started in 2015. Despite this progress, we're still a long way from an equitable outcome for targeted group businesses and state procurement. State spending with targeted group businesses has risen to 8.2%, but not yet to our current goal of 10%. We need these tools to expand our program. Thank you.
Any questions of the testifier? Representative Claiborne.
Thank you.
thank you very much for being here this morning, and I appreciate the intent of the bill. Could you please help me understand how we will know that the dollars are actually going to the targeted groups that it's intended to go to?
Ms. Robertson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is a certification process that businesses must go through in order to become part of our program. They apply through the Department of Administration. The Office of Equity and Procurement reviews their application. They, in most cases, interview the applicant and ensure that they actually are a targeted group business before they award that certification. And then there is an annual recertification process that they go through to ensure that the business is still owned by the original person who applied for the program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say for the vets who live in my district, this is something that is important to them as they are coming out of their service and wanting to start a business. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this program has been very effective for our veteran population as well. They've actually over-indexed in this program. We're working to ensure that minority women and substantial physical disability owners also are experiencing that same progress.
Thank you so much.
Any further questions? And anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? Representative Clowney, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And several years ago in the Claims Committee, because this bill touches on an area of the lower contracts and bids that we have out there so that we don't have the bonding and the protections in it. And I think it was a gentleman from, at that time, Representative Purcell's district, who was a subcontractor to someone that was awarded one of these. And the general got the money, the work was done, and the sub didn't get anything. And at that time, I had promised him that any opportunity to try and have some protection in, you know, in this type of area. I mean, I promised him, and I drafted a bill. It was past deadline. We did make the motion to suspend rules. It didn't go, which I wasn't surprised. But frankly, the area where you're below with the bonding, you know, you have to have a bond for the project. There's susceptibility to where the subs, hardworking people, do the work and don't get paid. So I would like an opportunity to maybe meet with the author, since you're touching on this area, and see if there's anything we could do to try and protect those people. Thank you.
Commissioner, are these contracts we're talking about, they go directly to the person applying for it? They wouldn't go to a general contractor first and then a sub, but the problem that he's discussing is an issue that we have in that in the contracting, in places where people subcontract and don't get paid. Commissioner.
Agreed, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to take that meeting and discuss it further. We don't see that issue too much with these Equity Select. These are generally for goods and services and not for construction typically, but certainly happy to talk about that more as a general issue.
Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, thank you. When it comes to the Claims Committee, it's the last resort. The courts, the person went to a jurisdiction where our legal system can't touch them. This was a person that was awarded and had, you know, someone below. I think it was a DNR in building rest facilities in parks, that, you know, he had this sunlight for lighting. And anyway, you know, it is an area that gets thorny, but it's also an area we should see if we can do something, we can help. And I do appreciate the intent of the author on this bill.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Any further questions? And I didn't see anybody running down to the dais, so with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 3616 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Bill's referred. The next bill we have on the today is Representative Freiberg is House File 3631. And members, this is going to be held over for further consideration. Wait to see if we get targets to spend. When that comes back, there may be issues to deal with that. So Representative Freiberg, if you want to move the bill, I'll move the bill for further reconsideration, and if you want to explain your bill.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a pretty straightforward bill. It would allocate $250,000 in each of the next two fiscal years to the Department of Administration to award grants to various entities to provide sensory accommodations. So I don't know if everybody knows this, but I'm an autism parent. So sometimes people who have autism spectrum disorder find it beneficial to do some activities to help, just to help process things. I'm not doing a good job of explaining this, but we do have, I know there will be some examples of this that we can hand out to the committee that the testifier will hand out. So, you know, my family, we go to sensory-friendly concerts at Orchestra Hall, and some, you know, we've invested in noise-canceling headphones and so forth, but this is something that not every entity is used to thinking about, and many don't have the resources to do it. So happy to turn it over to the testifier. I have a few testifiers here with me.
I see she has some props. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jillian Nelson. I'm the community resource and policy advocate for the Autism Society of Minnesota. I am also an autistic adult myself, and I experience many sensory challenges. I will tell you, on a busy day at the Capitol, that is not a sensory-friendly place. I'm just walking through the rotunda. The movement of accessibility has been a hot topic throughout the Capitol complex this session. But with that, far too much of the conversation is focusing on accessibility modifications for public spaces focusing on individuals with physical needs, such as parking, ramps, and bathrooms. And while we celebrate this progress and rejoice in the reduction of barriers, these changes do not increase accessibility for a large portion of the disability community. If we are going to focus on building inclusion and creating one Minnesota, then we need to include individuals with sensory needs, which often comes with invisible disabilities. Individuals with autism comprise 1 in 42 Minnesotans. We are the second largest in the nation with prevalence numbers. But we are not the only group that is impacted by sensory challenges. It also impacts people with PTSD, mental health challenges, developmental disabilities, and more. House File 3631 is a 2-year grant appropriation, as we heard, that will allow for increased accessibility for individuals with disabilities requiring sensory accommodations in public spaces. The bill outlines 4 options that can be funded through the grant, including a quiet sensory-friendly zone, design modifications to meet sensory-friendly standards, mobile kits to be used in the space. All of these things in front of me are things that come out of our own mobile kits that we take to events, and or additional service time or spaces meant to provide a quieter service experience. I have examples of some of the tools that might be utilized in this type of support in front of me. The bill also has an expectation that organizations utilizing the grants will have appropriate training on utilizing these modifications so they're not done in vain. Our community has built our own accommodations for years in this arena and has gratefully had an influx of community partnerships in creating accessible recreation options. The Minnesota Vikings, the Minnesota Wild, are soon to be joined by the Minnesota Timberwolves and the Twins for sensory accommodation space. We have seen groups such as Children's Theater, the Walker Arts Center, Minnesota Orchestra, Como Zoo, Minnesota Zoo, Three River Parks, Minneapolis Parks, the Bakken Museum, the Science Museum, the Children's Museum, the Bell Museum, and also the Guthrie Theater, who we'll share with you shortly. And while arts and recreations are vital to a meaningful life, this is not the only realm that people with sensory challenges require accessibility. I personally find it reprehensible that our state is leading the way in community sensory inclusion, while our public spaces that are vital to civic and community engagement are still inaccessible from a sensory standpoint. This bill will create opportunities to create an accessible space in public arenas that are vital to many areas of our life. We must appear in county buildings to access supports. We need access to government buildings to advocate for our rights. We need to be in the places that allow us to access navigating our services, communities, and protections in a dignified manner without causing harm or discomfort. I'd like to open it up to Jen Ryder, who is a parent that has required many of these supports for her child.
Ms. Ryder, if you want to come down, and you can pull that chair over so that Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
My name is Jennifer Ryder, and I would like to thank you, Chair and Committee, for allowing me to share a little bit about my beautiful daughter, Olivia. She's 13. She has autism. And at the start of our journey 10 years ago, most every place we'd want to go recreationally or to access services was extremely challenging for her. Her sensory needs are profound. She has what my husband and I call bionic hearing. We first discovered this when she was 3 in a gorgeous Minnesota freezing day, had the heaters on, dishwasher on, and she kept crying and screaming and demanding for us to stop the noise. We turned off everything we could find, and she could still hear the noise. And I opened the door and could faintly hear a plane overhead that I had to stretch to even hear in that moment. And so we were unsure we would get to have her anywhere in the community where she could build connections, enjoy her love of arts, science, music, access therapies that she needed. And with initiatives like sensory friendly items, these tools help. But now as she's older and will continue to need accommodations through her entire lifespan, she needs to access new places, state capital, to share her story, DMV, to one day get a license. Those places are intolerable for her. She also has super strong smelling, and she can smell paint months after it's been there. But there are a lot of simple accommodations, headphones, having sunglasses, because fluorescent lights are difficult for her. As you can see, she's outside using headphones, a fidget, a little bit of music that helps her calm. And the other challenge, and this is where staff training and monies for staff training is vital, is training staff to know that if I said, hello, how are you, to her, she needs extra time to process that. It can feel a little awkward communicating with her sometimes because of that extra processing. But with training, some of these spaces that Julian mentioned start to become more accessible, making her feel more welcome. And at the Walker, where she now thinks that she is on the Walker staff and has made friends with everyone there and has discovered a talent for art by working with the artists there on sensory-friendly Sundays, she now has a career path because of accommodations, that she can see a place for her. She now has made neurotypical friends because of accommodations like this. She now can advocate for herself about sensory needs she needs for certain therapies out in the world, and has opened up her life in incredible ways that I could talk about clearly for hours and hours and hours. And I just urge you to think about these accommodations that we will need, because my grandparents with Alzheimer's need accommodations. It's not just autism, but autism is opening a door to this lens. So thank you.
Well, thank you for your story. Members, any questions for the testifier? I also have a Hunter Gullickson.
The Autism Society of Minnesota produces a sensory-friendly guide every year that gives families opportunities to understand where they can find sensory-friendly things. We're passing some of these out to the committee just to get an idea of what that kind of community that creates. There's also some really great articles in there on why this matters.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, and Representative Freiberg, thank you for bringing this bill. I would like to ask, yesterday was Epilepsy Day, and we were talking about harsh lighting for causing seizures and things like that. Would that also be covered in this bill?
The second opportunity is modify public use spaces to meet sensory friendly design standards. It's very early in the morning for me, guys. That is exactly what that covers. So making really simple business accommodations like switching out fluorescent lights, or in our office we have filters over all of our fluorescent lights because our building is too old for us to put in the investment as a nonprofit to change out all the fluorescent lighting. So we have filters that actually filter the light down from the fluorescent tones to a natural daylight tone, which has an incredibly profound impact. The people without autism in our office don't even notice it, but the impact it has on those of us that work there with autism, or the people that visit our community, is breathtakingly amazing to see how it changes those dynamics in meetings. And those are the really simple accommodations that this bill could help public spaces make.
And Ms. Nelson, I know that they now sell LED tubes to replace fluorescent bulbs. Is that help? Are those helpful, or does that have the same issues?
They are absolutely helpful.
Representative Lippert.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, and I appreciate this bill and this work. My question was related to sensory design standards as well. So your response to Representative Cleburne was helpful for me. So thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Hunter Gullickson, and good morning. Thanks for allowing me to be here to speak on behalf and support this bill. I am the accessibility manager at the Guthrie Theater. I've worked at the Guthrie for more than 20 years, and I'm continually looking for ways to make our building more accessible, our services and programs. I sincerely feel fortunate that I have been given the privilege to have that position, to be able to create and maintain these vital programs. Additionally, I serve on the board of the Minnesota Access Alliance. It's a local organization looking to raise the bar for accessibility across culture and arts sectors in Minnesota, and I provide support throughout the region for organizations looking to make improvements within their own accessibility offerings. Real quickly, with accessibility planning, the ultimate goal is to strive for universal design. And that's the design of buildings, environments, programs to make them more accessible, to make them accessible to all people, regardless of age, ability, or other factors. And the idea is really pretty simple. It's, design for everybody. But the application, that's where it becomes difficult because you're thinking about existing buildings, budgets, transportation, and other barriers to participation. A good friend of mine once told me that she didn't see herself as having a disability. She saw our building as being disabled for not being able to accommodate her without making special accommodations. And that was really impactful for me. And something that I hold dearly and will not forget. The Guthrie's version of sensory-friendly programming, we call it relaxed performances. The intention is to be sensitive to and accepting of audience members who may benefit from a more relaxed theater-going experience. This includes reducing loud noises, looking at and removing strobe effects that gets to the lighting aspect. And most importantly, it allows us to welcome patrons into our home where they're free to come as they are and not be questioned. We provide materials to help them prepare for the visit. We establish quiet areas within our lobbies and then work to build trust with various communities. I think one important thing that you learn with accessibility planning is that if you intend to make something accessible for one particular community, you find out further down the road that it becomes more accessible to additional people that you may not have been thinking about. Early on, we established a committee that put community members and staff in the same room working to plan this programming and have partnered with the Autism Society of Minnesota and other social service organizations to foster essential relationships for us. The response from the public has been overwhelmingly positive, and these performances have also had profound effects on our staff and volunteers. And this is from colleagues, who are applying the principles taught in training seminars, finding ways that their own job is important to our accessibility efforts. To those with families who have finally been able to feel they can attend performances as a whole unit. And I think it's really important to reiterate that notion. If a family includes someone who has autism, vestibular sensitivities, other health issues with sensory impacts, and other members who do not, it becomes very important, very difficult for them to find enrichment activities where the whole family can participate together. And this programming is allowing that to happen. And time again, people are attending these performances have told us that the visit is the first time they've ever felt they could attend live theater. And this gets to the heart of my support for this program. Many organizations mention in their mission statement something along the lines of, we are welcome to all people. And I know the sentiment is sincere, but I'm also keenly aware that many are lacking the ability to make this inclusive goal a reality. Cost to implementing this is a legitimate deterrent that facilities must overcome. I think the funding with this bill allows our friends, neighbors, and colleagues to feel safe going places, knowing that design standards are being met and that they can receive support from trained staff if it's needed. I personally feel that it's also important that holders of public spaces have the opportunity to create meaningful change within their own spaces that allow more people to walk through the doors knowing that they belong there. One of my colleagues had sent this note after our first relaxed performance. It was as I was saying goodbye to patrons, a gentleman walked up to me and shared that his son was terminally ill and only had a few months left to live. Being able to attend this performance of her Christmas carol for the first and last time was a memory that he and his family would not forget. By building relationships and having open dialogue with the community, I've learned and am continually reminded of the fact that people need to know they can go places without having to fight for their access there. Thanks, it's an honor to be here, and I thank you for your time.
Any questions for the testifier? If not, thank you for your testimony.
What?
Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to speak for or against this bill? If not, is there anybody that wants to speak on?
It wouldn't be an autism discussion without Mr. McCourt.
I just want to be
welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Noah McCourt. I'm an autism advocate, and I wanted to thank the committee for hearing this bill today. I really think that oftentimes when we talk about accessibility, we often think of things as curb ramps or curb cutouts, and for a lot of people with autism, including myself, there is a significant sensory aspect to accessibility that is often overlooked. And so if you look at the goals of Olmsted and the way that national disability policy is trending towards community inclusion, it's really important that everybody be able to access programs and activities in the community, and this bill allows for that. And so I know on behalf of myself and a lot of people with autism, we really ask for the support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Again, is there anybody else that wants to come and speak? If not, members, we're going to hold this over for a possible review. And Representative Freiberg, is there anything you need, want to say to wrap up? Or?
Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Thank you for the Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Freiberg, I just have a couple of clarifying questions. I think this is a fantastic program. So I think what my questions lead to is really more about the functioning of the protocols inherent in it. So with that in mind, just curious in terms of oftentimes when we take a look at these bills, it's dealt with in round numbers. And so $250,000 in 21 and $250,000 in 22. Not a leading question, but just curious in terms of how you arrived at that number.
Representative Freiberg. Ms. Nelson.
I might turn this one over to Ms. Nelson.
We looked at some of the numbers of what it's cost us to do sensory-friendly programming with other buildings that have made accommodations or other programs that have made accommodations, and kind of looked at how we could put in a number that would allow for reasonable access at different levels. So something like a mobile kit can be done for, had to have several mobile kits on hand and do training for around $1,000. But like building modifications to create sensory friendly design might be a bit higher. But we also want to arrive at a number that was inclusive enough that it's not something that would just be accessed by Metro, or so that we could see this happen in not just one space or two spaces, but in a wide opportunity of spaces throughout our state, our counties, and our cities across the entire state, so that we could have the widest impact for the greatest number of people throughout our state. Because we know that people with autism live beyond places like the metro area, which is where we see the greatest number of our current existing sensory-friendly programs. And I want people in Duluth, in Hibbing, in Mankato, in Rochester, in Laverne, Minnesota, to all also have sensory inclusion. So we wanted to kind of throw out a number that would allow for the most individuals to access this without being an excessive burden on the state.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Freiberg, in a number of these grant application projects, we oftentimes talk about the process, the application itself in terms of that a grantee would go through to be awarded a grant. Is there a standard process that you're intending to follow? Is it different? If you could allow the committee to understand what that process looks like.
Representative Freiberg.
Well, this is through the Department of Administration Office of Grant Management, which obviously has a lot of experience in that department. So, you know, they would develop a protocol, I'm sure, and it would be handled even-handedly. I don't know. And I don't know if they're still here and want to speak more about their process generally, but.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you mentioned the value of some of the grants themselves, whether they be $1,000. Is there a min-max that you're looking for in terms of the number of contracts that would be awarded to specific focuses, if you will, whether they be mobile versus structural?
We don't have any specific goals regarding the number for each one. We're a firm believer at the Autism Society of Minnesota is that it's each program, it's each spaces. They know what's best for their community. I'm like looking at our sports teams, the Minnesota Vikings, the Minnesota Timberwolves, and the Minnesota Twins all have a sensory-friendly space. The Minnesota Wild wanted to come to the table. They wanted to be inclusive, but they didn't have a space available that they could do that, so they opted into the mobile option where you can go to customer service and check out items just like these and take them back to your seat. So our goal is to allow each space to figure out what's going to fit best for the needs of that space and the work that they're doing in that space. Like somewhere like the DMV, a quiet space would probably be the best option there. But for somewhere like a courthouse, mobile kits would be much more useful for the way you have to use that public space. So we wanted to leave a lot of flexibility to allow those public spaces that need to be accessible to figure out what's going to work best for the goals of being in that space.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Freiberg, as I look at the bill, I kind of see two focal points of the bill. One is about the provision for the four focal points, but in your last section, lines 1.19 through 1.21, you talk about also completing disability training. I'm just wondering who would be providing that training, and is that training inclusive of the grant itself, or is that an additional expenditure that's made on behalf of the grantee by administration? If you could just elaborate on that.
Sure.
Representative Freiberg.
Sure. There are lots of organizations out there that provide training. I assume the Autism Society does. I know there are organizations like Fraser out there. I mean, it would be up to the grantees to determine what goes into their application. If they didn't have the funding for training, I think that could certainly be a component of the grants. You know, just to give you one personal example, my son goes to Fraser for different types of therapy, but you know there are challenges at times from having somebody with autism in your house, including to siblings, and they actually offer a sibling support program through Fraser. So my daughter, who's neurotypical, went through that program and learned a bit more about what it means to have autism. It's very helpful for parents as well. This is an area I knew very little about up until 4 years ago when my son got diagnosed. You know, there are lots of different types of training opportunities out there, and that could certainly be a part of the grant as well.
Representative Freiberg, or Albright.
We look alike.
So. Yeah, you look alike, yes.
Representative Freiberg.
He has more hair.
And to the testifiers, if this is not to be, I'll put it this way. How will we know we're successful?
Representative Freiberg.
The office of, I'm certainly be willing to look to put in some sort of explicit evaluation process in the bill as this moves forward. The Office of Grant Management, the Department of Administration, I know regularly evaluates the grants that go out. I don't know if you have any additional thoughts.
Ms. Nelson.
A program like this reveals its success when you look around the space. I have been a part of the disability community my whole life. But one of the single most profound impactful moments I've ever experienced was on that first night of the first relaxed performance at the Guthrie Theater. And I stood in the back of the house with Hunter as the lights were starting to go down. And all you could hear throughout the entire theater was, I like to call it the song of my people. The noises and the stimming and the vocal noises and some of the noises that sensory tools make, and happy, joyous noise. And I spent the rest of the night on a headset. My job there was to intervene if anything happened and we needed additional level support with someone that had more experience with disabilities than the theater staff. My radio didn't go off the entire night, and I looked at Hunter and said, I'm useless. And that is how I know that this program is working, because my need to intervene and support is absolutely unnecessary. So we will know this is working when we walk into that building and we see people of all different need types comfortably there, when we don't see those crisis moments happening. And it's like the field, to quote the Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come. There are so many of us existing in this community that are staying behind closed doors, that are not going places because it is not accessible. And we will know it's working when we see those people in those community spaces living a truly full and inclusive life, being able to advocate for themselves, being able to get their needs met.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Mr. Representative Freiberg, I wish you every success.
Thank you. So with that, seeing no further questions, we're going to hold this over for further consideration. Thank you, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you.
The next bill we have is Representative Elkins, House File 1358, and again, we're going to be holding this over for possible for further consideration. And members, we've heard this bill once before last year. There's a DE, and I'll move the bill, House File 1358. And Representative Elkins, you want to move your DE-1 amendment?
Yes. I'd like to move the DE amendment that's in the package here. Basically, the DE amendment puts the bill back into the standalone bill back in the position that it was within the our omnibus bill at the end of the session. So it was included in our proposal, but did not survive conference committee. So we're basically, this will put us back. We're basically picking up where we left off last year.
With that, Representative Elkins, do you want to explain your bill? Explain the amendment, I guess, which is now the bill.
Well, the amendment, which is now the bill, establishes a council to administer the grants, and this is a kind of a pilot program. So the council that is described in here basically is the main stakeholder organizations. The purpose of the grant is to help smaller cities and counties that don't have sophisticated IT capabilities to make their websites more digitally accessible. And so we have the cities, the counties, Minute represented as well. And we have representatives from all of those stakeholder organizations here with us today in case there are more detailed questions. But I have with me Cody Olson from the Minnesota Council on Disabilities, and Noah McCord, a self-advocate, who's the one who originally brought me this bill. So,
and members, I guess we have to vote on. I forgot that we need to vote on the DE amendment. So, all in favor of the DE-1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion's passed.
Yep. So, I think this is. Do you have a statement you want to?
And welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cody Olson, and I am the public policy director for the Minnesota Council on Disability. The council is in strong support of this bill, which would provide grant funding to empower local governments with the tools and the training needed to ensure that their digital presence is accessible to Minnesotans with disabilities. As buildings need ramps and sidewalks need curb cuts, so too does our digital environment need to be accessible for all. The digital realm is no longer a privilege for some, it's a right for all. Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act requires that our government and its services be fully accessible for everybody. Much of government business today is conducted digitally, ranging from snow emergency alerts to informational videos on public health, applying for permits and paying taxes and fines. Accessible government, especially digital government, allows for people with disabilities to live independently in the community of their choice. The need is tremendous, and the bill is a right step forward. We appreciate the support of Representative Elkins and the committee on this bill. And as we continue to fine-tune the language, we continue to engage with stakeholders, including the Department of Administration, local government, and advocates to ensure that the digital world is accessible for all. Thank you.
And Mr. McCourt, we can again restate your name for the record, and you can proceed.
I'm Noah McCourt, and I'm a self-advocate for people with autism. And I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate File 1358, which appropriates funding to support cities and counties in bringing the websites into compliance with Title II of the ADA and also Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, 56.7 million people, that's nearly one in five Americans, have a disability, such as vision loss, hearing loss, or mobility impairments. People with disabilities face many challenges when websites are not accessible. For example, individuals who are blind may not be able to navigate a website using a screen reader. The website does not properly label graphics, and individuals who are deaf are not able to understand the narration in an online video if it's not properly captioned. This is another example that is often overlooked as well. Many people with autism experience issues with executive functioning and motor skill challenges. And when government entities fail to make their websites accessible, people with disabilities are unable to access important government services and information. Before being updated, the Minnesota Management and Budget Office hiring page required an individual with a disability to press tab over 500 times. Unfortunately, this is not uncommon, as according to a recent study by the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, in D.C., they found that 85% of government websites are, in fact, not accessible to people with disabilities. In Minnesota specifically, there are really two sides to this issue. Minnesota Statute 16E.04 establishes guidelines and processes for website accessibility, but it really only applies to the state. And then there's the issue of local government, which is obligated under Title II of the ADA and Section 508, to make their websites accessible. Minnesotans with disabilities continue to be left behind in both regards. The internet is dramatically changing the way the government serves the public. Local government websites are particularly important because they offer citizens a variety of different services, including corresponding with local officials, providing information about government services, and even renewing library books. There has actually been a 30% uptick from last year, according to Chicago-based law firm Seifert & Shaw, in regards to digital accessibility lawsuits. It is a fast-growing area of litigation. Usually you see an increase in civil suits when there's a new law. The ADA has been around for 30 years, and so a lot of people are asking why now. The first reason is that many potential plaintiffs have been waiting for the U.S. Department of Justice to issue their interpretation and regulations as to how the ADA applies to websites. That never happened. DOJ decided to extend the deadlines again, and a wave of lawsuits hit the federal court system that year and the next. The second reason lies in the way that websites have been developed. As we have moved forward as a society, the functionality of websites back in the day was fairly basic. They looked like posters. The functionality was simple, but as the internet took off, accessibility became less and less of a factor, and the focus has declined. By supporting localities and developing accessible designs for websites, we really begin to move forward towards a more inclusive, open, and transparent government whose information and services are available to all Minnesotans. I want to thank Representative Elkins for championing this not-so-flashy and yet practical piece of legislation, and I urge the committee to support House File 1358.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions of the bill author or test of the testifier, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the the author. About 6 years ago, I had a constituent who was trying to find information because the confusion was they were dropping off a check for, I think it was child support, and they were dropping it off several days before the end of the month, and that they discovered they were in arrears because of the processing stuff. It'd have to be dropped off the week before, and it wasn't being credited and this and that. But the issue really is, even if you have a website and it's accessible, is the data available for the people? And I like the intent of the bill. I would love it if there was some effort made requiring that certain basic things, policies and procedures, are available to the public. At that time, I tried a bill. Oh, this is just an erroneous, it's a horrible burden upon us to actually, you know, be forced to have all of our policies and procedures and stuff out and available. And, you know, frankly, I hear in committee of where, you know, materials come in, and sometimes it comes in, you know, while we're discussing a bill. But there are people that they need a device to be able to see it. You know, for them, they need something that's accessible through here. And it does no good if we have full accessibility, but we don't have the content. So I think the next phase, or possibly it'd be nice to have included in this phase, is some way of ensuring the content is there too. So good luck with your efforts. Thank you.
Representative Elkins, do you want to respond or?
No, a good welcome comment.
Any further questions? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and probably to the bill author. I see in subdivision two, we're talking about setting up an advisory council, and I believe that's done through the Department of Administration. My question is, I realize there's no fiscal note because it's a direct appropriation, but how much do they expect that this is going to cost for them to administer and then also to run this committee?
Representative Elkins.
Thank you. I think I'll ask Mr. Olson to comment on that as well, but we started this last year, and at the time, the Council on Disabilities didn't really feel confident in their ability to administer a grant program because they'd never done it before. So I think if you look at the participation of the department administration as kind of hand-holding for this year. Next year, when we bring this back again as part of the budget process, we may very well just have the council itself administer the grants. They feel much more comfortable doing so at this point. But that would also, because the Minnesota Council on Disabilities is under the jurisdiction of the Health and Human Service Finance Committee, the bill would travel through a different path and would be starting all over if we did that right now.
Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I applaud the effort because I do think, especially working collaboratively for all these agencies, whether it's local municipalities, counties, or whatever. I know Scott County has done an excellent job with scale where they're bringing all of the local governments together to work on things. So I believe in the concept. My concern is that when we create a committee, that generally there's some administrative costs that goes with it as well as running the committee, and we'll take the $200,000 and maybe lose 10 or 20% of that to things that are going on around but not going directly to solving the problem. So that was the question, Mr. Chair. That's why I didn't know what department administration was looking at, how much is going to kind of be lost in the administration of the program.
We have someone from
and I see we have someone coming down here from the Department of Administration. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Lori Barkopensky. Right now I'm the interim executive director of the Council on Disabilities, but I am on loan from the Department of Administration, where one of my programs is the Office of Grants Management. Last year, we, in working with the author and in addressing the fiscal costs, we expected that having to staff a council as well as manage these grants would require at least 15% of the grant funds. We've been working with the author to have tweaked language that would eliminate the new council and allow us to use the Council on Disabilities and admin working together to coordinate this grant program. And we expect that would be about 10%.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Any further questions? Anyone else in the audience that would like to speak for or against this bill? Seeing no one rushing to the dais, Representative Elkins will hold this over for possible consideration. If you want to give a wrap up,
we had a training class on creating accessible documents for House staff about a month or so ago, and I attended and listened in, and it was useful for me to know that. The requirements to make a website or a document digitally accessible aren't rocket science, actually, and a lot of local governments are doing a really good job. But it's pretty basic training in some cases.
Well, thank you. With that, members, we'll hold this bill over. And members, that's the last of our agenda for today. We'll post an agenda later today for next week. And with that, members, we're adjourned.